Good afternoon. My name is Debbie, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I'd like to welcome everyone to the Climate Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you'd like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Please limit questions to 1. Thank you. Dr. Joseph Rome, please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for joining the call. I'm Dr. Joseph Rome, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and editor of the blog climateprogress.org. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone on the line that this call is being recorded. By participating in the call, you consent to be recorded. Shortly after the event, the audio will be posted at americanprogress.org. For further information regarding this press call, please call Christina at 202-481-8181. Joining me on the call is the Honorable Sherwood Bollard, who was chairman of the House Science Committee, and Dr. Peter Glick, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and the director of the Pacific Institute, and a climate expert. Let me just open by saying that, for decades now, climate scientists have been predicting that if we kept pouring billions of tons of heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere, that the planet would warm up, that ice would melt, and we would see more and more extreme weather, heat waves, and intense deluges in particular. And now it's coming true. And I think we've moved into the era of from predictions to observations of climate change. At the same time, the same scientists, whether it's the National Academy of Sciences or the Australian Climate Commission or many other groups, have warned that if we don't act soon, the weather will get more extreme and the climate will get hotter and there will be other impacts. In the face of this growing and overwhelming scientific evidence, there are, I think, a dwindling number of increasingly vocal people who spread disinformation on climate science and who attack and harass climate scientists. I would direct people today, the American Association for the Advancement of Science took the pretty unusual step of issuing a statement on personal attacks on climate scientists. I'll just read the two opening lines. "We are deeply concerned by the extent and nature of personal attacks on climate scientists. Reports of harassment, death threats, and legal challenges have created a hostile environment that inhibits the free exchange of scientific findings and ideas and makes it difficult for factual information and scientific analyses to reach policymakers and the public." So let me just say, introduce again, the first speaker will be Sherry Bollard, who was chairman of the House Science Committee. Sherry?
Thank you very much. I've come to the conclusion that climate science, climate change, is one of the most compelling issues of our time, and we've got to deal with it in a responsible manner. Now, I'm not a scientist, but for 24 years, I served in the House, all 24 of those years, on the House Science Committee, the last six of which I was chairman of the committee. And for 24 years, I was witness to a parade of experts, some of the nation's and indeed the world's foremost scientists, coming before our panel and testifying that climate change is for real. Humans are contributing to it. We have to. It has serious negative consequences, and we have to deal with it in a responsible manner. So I came to this conclusion not because of any great scientific ability on my own, but I was informed by people who we look to give us guidance as we establish public policy. And I am just distraught at what is happening now. I say to myself, where do the American people go to get the facts? It's a known fact that the majority of people get their opinions of policy and policymakers based upon what they see primarily on television or what they hear on radio or read in the newspapers. And where do they go to get the facts? What we have, particularly on television, are opinion merchants, very articulate, very able people who give their opinions, but they are short on facts. And that is a disturbing characteristic of the American dialogue right now. And now in retirement, I am devoting an inordinate amount of my time to trying to build bridges between scientists and those who are concerned about the environment, build bridges to my fellow Republicans. And I must say that I wish I had a lot more success, but I've noted some success. And the fact of the matter is there are a dwindling few who are denying the science. 97% of the world's climate scientists agree that climate change is for real, humans are contributing to it, it has negative consequences, and we must deal with it in a responsible manner. I note that this season, when there are a lot of pretenders to the throne, the two leading Republican potential nominees, Mitt Romney, former governor of Massachusetts, John Huntsman, former governor of Utah, both are of the mind that the climate science is for real. I note that a good number of my fellow Republicans in positions of responsibility in the U.S. Congress, people like my classmate, we came to Congress together, John McCain, senator from Arizona, has acknowledged climate science is for real and has had some important statements on that. A fellow colleague from the House days who went on to the Senate, Lindsey Graham, says it is for real and we have to deal with it in a responsible way. There are a number of others, Dave Reichert, congressman from Washington, Susan Collins, a senator from Maine. There are a whole bunch of key legislators who agree with the basic thrust of our presentation today, that science is for real and we've got to deal with it in a responsible manner. Now, there are various themes on the best way to deal with it, but none of these people, after thorough study, after being informed by respected people with international reputations, say we've got to, they have some differences of opinion on how best to deal with it, but all of them agree we have to deal with it, and we can't keep putting it off because our children and grandchildren will suffer if we do. So I am proud to be identified with this effort. I am dismayed by those who call it a hoax. I note one of my former colleagues in the House, now a U.S. senator, is going to keynote a program this week, Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma. He says climate science is a big hoax. Well, I sat next to Jim Inhofe on the Transportation Committee when we served in the House together. He's one of the nicest guys I know, but he's completely out to lunch on this subject. He just doesn't understand it. And I try to figure out why. And I think I've come up with a theory, at least it's my theory, that the way to get attention in the media today is make the most outrageous statement. If you just say, well, 97% of the world's scientists agree that it's for real, we've got to deal with it, ho-hum. But if you're among the dwindling few who say it's a hoax or it's a big a ruse being perpetrated by sinister characters, I've yet to find a sinister character who's trying to perpetuate a snow job on the American people. But I think one of the basic problems is when we got off on the battle to deal responsibly with climate change, we saw a lot of very slick ads on television showing polar bears on ever-shrinking ice floes, or snow caps in the Himalayas melting, and then some ominous voice said this has dire consequences. Well, guess what? The majority of American people, families, have probably never seen a polar bear. And if you challenge them, they probably couldn't identify precisely where the Himalayas are. That's not relevant to their daily lives. What is relevant to their daily lives is what climate change is doing and the impact it has on each and every American family. And so I am going to continue my efforts, and I proudly identify with this group, and I would hope we have some good questions, and we'll get some a healthy dialogue going. Thanks so much, Joe.
thanks so much, Jerry. Peter?
Yes, hello, everybody. This is Peter Glick from the Pacific Institute. As Joe mentioned, I'm a hydroclimatologist by training. I've worked for probably 30 years now on the connections between climate change and water resources. I'm a member of the National Academy of Sciences. I'm a MacArthur Fellow. Let me first express my appreciation to Sherry Bowler. He's a shining example for a long time of the understanding the importance of integrating good science with policy. His work on the House Science Committee has really been remarkable. And I remember my first testimony to Congress was 24 years ago on the issue of climate and water. This isn't a new challenge for policymakers, but he really does represent an effort to integrate science into policy. I'm going to keep my remarks really short. I'd like to try and differentiate between science and policy. Of course, what you're going to hear is my interpretation and my understanding of the science. I would start with the observation that there is no scientific body of national or international standing that rejects the findings of human-induced effects on the global climate. Every National Academy of Sciences of every country of the world, every major scientific body in the geophysics, chemistry, physics, biology, geology, hydrology, acknowledges human influence on climate. Our understanding of the science has grown for decades. It just gets stronger and stronger and more deep and complex. There's plenty of science still to do, but the fundamentals are incredibly strong. There's very clear evidence that the climate is already changing. There's very clear evidence that humans are the dominant influence over natural impacts on climate. There's very clear evidence that there's a growing influence of human-induced climate change on extreme weather events. Now, not attribution. I'm not saying that climate change is causing hurricanes or causing flooding. I think we're going to see more and more of that. But there is clear evidence that it's influencing extreme events. It's making some extreme events worse than they would otherwise be. It's shifting the locations of them. And again, there are examples from the literature on precipitation intensity, on storm events, and so on. There's also clear evidence that there will be serious and growing bad impacts on societies. Climate change is going to cause a lot of different kinds of impacts, good potentially and bad potentially. But the scientific evidence suggests that the negative impacts on societies are going to outweigh the good impacts, partly because we've built our infrastructure and built our societies for the climate of yesterday, not the climate of tomorrow. On the policy side, I really think the difficult question is not the science, but the policy. It's what do we do about it? And a lot of the comments that Sherry Bowlert made about the politics, I think, really reflect a reluctance to talk about the policy, to tackle the really difficult policy questions that we need to tackle. If the science is good, then policymakers have to do something, and we've been avoiding that. And this is now I'm segueing, as you may know, from science to opinion. These are my opinions. I do believe the voices against climate change are diminishing as the science continues to strengthen, and I think they're conflicted. Some say climate change that climate isn't changing. Some say it is changing, but it's not humans. Some say it is humans, but humans have a small impact. Some say, yes, humans are important, but the impacts won't be bad. Some say the impacts might be bad, but we can't afford to deal with the problem. There's a very serious set of conflicts among the voices that are speaking out against climate change, and the media should think about those distinctions when they choose to write about them. I'm going to stop there. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you, Peter and Sherry. I guess I would just sum up that you know, the scientific community has increasingly been speaking with one voice, and as Sherry describes it, the testimony of the scientific community, of the scientific literature, has grown increasingly clear cut and strong. As Peter said, I think that on the science, the credible voices that saying humans aren't influencing the climate, and that things aren't going to, you know, that there will not be dangerous impacts if we continue doing nothing, the number of credible voices, I think, continues to shrink. Let's take some questions and get some answers.
Joe, if I may, Sherry here, I just want to add one thought.
Sure.
There's a disturbing trend among the ever-shrinking number of those who don't agree with the science. And that trend is, when they don't agree with the science, there's an all-out attempt to discredit the scientists, kill the messenger, if you will. And that is deeply disturbing.
And that's what the AAAS statement today explicitly addresses. This is Peter.
Great. Thank you both. Operator, could you please turn it over to questions?
Sure. As a reminder, to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. There will be a slight delay as we compile the Q&A roster. Again, please press *1. Your first question comes from the line of Evan McMorris-Santor with Talking Point Memo.
Hi, thanks for having the call. I wanted to ask the congressman to elaborate a bit more on what he was saying. It strikes me that this conference coming up tomorrow of, I guess, skeptics or climate change deniers, depending on where you stand, actually comes at a moment when climate change skepticism is at its ascendancy in the Republican Party. Beyond Romney and Huntsman, both of whom have taken very, very hard hits from the Republican base for saying that climate change is real, none of the other people running for president on the Republican side will say that it's real. And in fact, you have people like Pawlenty, who used to think it was real and now think that it isn't. So I wonder if you could elaborate some more, you know, if you think that the Republican Party is maybe sort of, you know, backsliding on this issue in terms of as someone who believes that, you know, it is a real thing. It just seems to me that everyone who's running and everyone who's speaking and the Republican base itself is not interested at all in the climate change issue and is more and more skeptical of the science itself.
Well, the first part, I don't agree with that analysis that they're running away from the issue. But I can understand what's taking place right now in the Republican Party as the field becomes increasingly larger of people who aspire to the nomination. They are focusing on the economy, they're focusing on the debt and the ever-growing deficits. They're saying we have to get our fiscal house in order. We have to reduce the national debt. We have to limit the ever-growing deficits. We've got to tackle the most serious problem in the lives of many Americans, and it involves a four-letter word that you can use in polite company. It's jobs. And so while a number of those potentials might think and agree that climate change is for real, and know intellectually that we have to deal with it responsibly sooner rather than later, They're afraid that if they focus any of their attention then other than the need for jobs, the need to get our economy back in order because so many houses are underwater, and the need to get moving in the right direction in terms of getting our fiscal house in order, they're afraid if they deviate 1 millimeter from that basic thrust of attention, they will be accused of taking their eye off the ball.
Your next question comes from the line of Dan Vergana with USA Today.
Thanks very much. I was wondering if the congressman could maybe elaborate on that a little bit. I'm wondering, from your viewpoint, what role does primary politics play in this position in the Republican Party? We've heard people point to past elections where West Virginia congressman was challenged in the primary. I think he lost. People have said that if people like Senator Rockefeller were to come out and say, you know, he says that it's a problem, but, you know, not going to do something about it now. If he were to come and say time to do something about it, he would face a serious primary challenger that would really sap a lot of his funding and that sort of thing.
No, well, look at, for example, at what happened to Senator Graham, who is a very thoughtful legislator. He authored his big sin among some of his constituents in South Carolina. His big sin was that he co-authored an op-ed piece which appeared in the New York Times with John Kerry on a bipartisan basis dealing with this very important issue. And what happened back home? Those who agreed with him were sort of silent, and the largest club in the state, the Republican club, censured him, had a vote to actually censure their senator. They were silent on the governor's activities, and you know what happened to him. But they censured Graham. That's unfortunate. Part of the problem is this. I say to myself, where do the American people go to get the facts? Just present them the facts. I have confidence in the American people that given the facts, they can draw the correct conclusion. Now, don't say right conclusion. I have an aversion to the right. The correct conclusion. But they have slick opinion merchants. On the left, you have MSNBC. On the right, you have Fox. And you have very able, articulate commentators on both sides of the equation. But they are opinion merchants. And so I challenge publications like USA Today, for which I have high regard, to provide more comprehensive coverage of the subject, not the battle between sides, not the battle between the 97% who agree it's for real and the 3% going rapidly down to 2%. Hopefully it will evaporate. Not that battle, but provide the facts. I'd like to pick up USA Today or any other publication or turn on my television or radio and hear an interview or read about an interview with Dr. Ralph Cicerone, who's president of the National Academy of Science. He is a distinguished climate scientist. But if I Googled him, I doubt very much if I would see him quoted in other than scientific publications. You've got to get into the mainstream. This affects every single American family. And they should be sitting down at the kitchen table and talking about what climate change means and how they can deal with it. And so they'll be prompted to write their legislators and urge action.
I've interviewed Dr. Cicerone many times, for what it's worth. Thanks for the answer, sir.
Your next question comes from the line of Dave Michaels with the Dallas Morning.
Yeah, hi, it's the Dallas Morning News. A question for Mr. Bullard. You mentioned that you had served on the Science Committee for a long time in the House. I'm curious what you think of the work that the Science Committee has done so far in this Congress on climate issues. Chairman Hall from Texas seems to have used the committee to highlight the climate change controversy or the climate gate controversy and has attacked federal programs that study climate change or try to address it with spending programs. What do you think that the committee has addressed this sufficiently or has been unhelpful?
I think the committee, I mean, it's early in the new majority, and it's early in Chairman Hall's position at the helm. I would recommend highly that Chairman Hall do what I did twice, and that is go down to Antarctica. Why Antarctica? First of all, the Science Committee has jurisdiction over the National Science Foundation and the Polar Program, and we spent a ton of the taxpayers' money on the Polar Program. But the last time I went down to Antarctica, I brought along 9 House members. Got a call one day from an old friend and a former colleague in the House, John McCain, and said, I understand you're taking a science trip down to Antarctica. Do you mind if we join you? He said, I have 2 of my colleagues, Senator Susan Collins and Senator John Sununu, with me, and we're traveling independently in the Far East, and we'd like to join you. And I said, by all means. So 13 of us go down to Antarctica for 5 days. In Antarctica, we have McMurdo Station, where we have, under the auspices of the National Science Foundation, 1,100 scientists and support personnel operating in a physical plant that is worth an estimated $1 billion. Then we go down to the South Pole, where a new research lab has just been developed at a considerable cost, $250 million. And they have 260 scientists and support personnel down there. And our whole group received briefing after briefing from distinguished scientists in various disciplines. The whole purpose of the trip was not to learn more about climate change, although we hope to learn more about climate change. It was to learn more about what the scientists under the auspices of the National Science Foundation are doing, the importance of that work, and to be better informed as we went back to Washington to shape public policy. And in every instance, the scientists would give us a detailed briefing and answer questions, and more often than not would factor in how their research factored into the overall study of climate change. 10 of us from the House went down. 3 of us from the outset were believers, including me. 7 of the delegation was either agnostic or skeptical. When we came back, all 10 of them were believers. One notable case was Congressman Bob Inglis of South Carolina, who was so convinced that he came back and he got very active and proposed a straight carbon tax. Courageous thing to do. He wanted that revenue derived from the carbon tax to be given back to the taxpayers in the form of tax cuts. That proved to be a serious problem for him as he faced re-election, and as we all know, sadly, he lost the primary. But it's not by accident that the 3 senators who were there, one's no longer Senator John Sununu, but the 2 remaining senators who were exposed to those serious scientists talking about serious subjects are believers, John McCain and Susan Collins.
Dave, this is Peter Glick. If I could just add a quick comment. As a scientist, I've testified many times in front of the House and the Senate, and increasingly my experience is that the hearings that are going on are not fact-finding hearings. They're not designed to actually inquire about science anymore. They're increasingly theater in many ways. They're increasingly designed simply to express a preconceived notion, to support a preconceived point of view. And as a scientist, I find that disturbing. I would love to go back to the time when the House Science Committee actually had informational hearings where they really sought to find out, to educate the congressmen and the congresswomen and the senators about the science. But that's increasingly rare.
Could I just follow up and ask if, Mr. Bullard said that he had tried to build bridges between scientists and fellow Republicans. Have you had any attempts or any successes with that with members like Chairman Hall and Joe Barton, who is the senior member on the Energy and Commerce Committee.
Well, two of those guys, and it won't surprise you to learn that both Texans that have good relationships with both, good personal relationships. We have strong, strong differences on how we draw conclusions from the scientific evidence presented us. But I would point out in the last year's Waxman-Markey bill that passed the House, everyone thinks it was just a straight party line vote. It wasn't. There were what I refer to as the Enlightened Eight Republicans who supported that. I have found then and throughout my career in the House that oftentimes on issues like this, I would cast a vote and a colleague or friend of mine would say, you know, I think you're right, but, you know, I don't want to get the grief from back home, so I'll vote the other way. I understand that. That's the real politic, if you will. I don't agree with it, and frequently I went against the grain when I was in the House and went against my party if I need be, but I felt more comfortable with myself doing what I thought was right, doing what I thought the evidence led me to conclude.
Your next question comes from the line of Mike DiApollo with Bloomberg News.
Hi, thank you. I see that the Heartland Institute has invited the Center for American Progress to come to their denial fest this week, and I wondered if you planning on sending anyone, especially Dr. Rome, because they invite you to ask questions after every single panel, and I wondered if you are going, what sort of questions you asked, or Dr. Glick, for that matter, but I was just curious to see whether you were going to take them up on their offer.
Well, the center may send some people purely as reporters. I don't think that the people who are presenting, have standard talking points that they present that are long debunked in the scientific literature, and there's nothing to be gained by asking questions of people whose minds are not open to the scientific evidence, and I will say many of the people presenting have launched pretty scurrilous attacks on leading climate scientists, and I don't think that from a scientific perspective they're not credible sources. They're not trying to engage in a scientific process, and you know, I will make one point as a scientist. You know, when people say that human emissions of greenhouse gases are not warming the planet, aren't changing the climate, aside from the fact that, you know, they're called greenhouse gases for a reason, and if there were no greenhouse gases at all, the planet would be 60 degrees Fahrenheit colder. Our understanding of greenhouse gas impact on climate goes back many, many decades. And in order to actually explain the record warming, that last decade was the hottest on record, that 2010 was the hottest year tied with 2005, that it was the wettest year on record, all of these things predicted by climate scientists, you can't just assert that greenhouse gases don't warm the planet. You would actually have to not only come up with a different mechanism to explain the warming, but you'd have to come up with an entire new theory to explain what is negating the well-understood warming effect of greenhouse gases. So, you know, to say that human emissions are not warming up the planet and changing the climate, it really isn't a science. It's closer to astrology or flat Earth conspiracy theory type stuff.
This is Peter Glick. First of all, I haven't been invited to the Heartland Conference. Second, I wouldn't go. I go to too many meetings as it is. And the interesting science is being done elsewhere, of course. This is not a science conference. It's a political conference. It's a way for a small community, and I would argue a diminishing community, to get together in a self-support kind of role. Joe's point is that is right. There is no science that's going to be discussed there that's new or that is interesting. That's my background on that. And the Heartland Institute has a long history of misrepresenting science. There are all sorts of interesting examples recently with some work they suggested about the Arctic ice that turned out to be cherry-picking data and bad science, and it's just not worth a real scientist's time.
Your last question comes from the line of Jean Chimnick with Greenwire.
Hi, thanks for doing this call. I was curious, you know, I mean, we have the weather events that we've had in the last 6 months, and we have, you know, new reports coming out every week, and you say 97% of scientists are agreed. What has to happen for the popular perception to be that the science of climate change is settled? Is there one event that could probably lead to this, or is it some kind of political shift?
And who's that directed to?
Oh, anybody.
Well, let me. This is Joe Rome. Let me. Take a crack. Tony Lazarus at Yale has been doing his polling, they've been releasing results of their polling. Interestingly enough, he shows in the last year that there's been a rebound somewhat of Americans' understanding of climate science. But one of the points that he makes, and this is a point that Robert Brule of Drexel University has made, is that to the extent that there has been a change in Americans' view of the saliency of global warming as an issue, part of the responsibility is that, you know, in 2010, media coverage of the climate issue dropped over 40%, and it is down considerably from its peak in 2006 and 2007, in particular around 2007, the four IPCC reports. So, when the media covers a story less, the public naturally is less attuned to it and less informed on it. And obviously there is a major disinformation campaign out there, and one of the antidotes to the disinformation campaign is coverage, accurate coverage of the science by the media. So, you know, as you say, the weather's getting more extreme. NOAA just, released its report on 2010, explaining the remarkable extreme events. Many of you probably seen the work of Dr. Jeff Masters at Weather Underground, who basically said that, it was the most extreme event since in any one year since 1816, a massive volcano back then, and that it's not, in his mind, conceivable that it would have happened if it weren't in part for the contribution of greenhouse gases. So I think the reality of climate change and accurate reporting by the media will, are two key components of the public understanding. Because I agree with Sherry completely. I think the American public, is quite smart and quite able to understand that human emissions warm up the planet and put more water vapor in the atmosphere. And as I think the head of NOAA's Climate Research Center said, wet areas get wetter and dry areas get drier, and that's what we've been seeing.
This is Peter Glick. I'm actually not optimistic that we, the American public or American policymakers, are really going to tackle this issue. I've been working on climate for a long time, and we haven't made really any progress on the policy side, even as the science gets stronger and stronger. Because the policy questions are truly difficult. They're very difficult questions. And the fact that we're avoiding talking about them, that there's been so much focus on the science rather than what we ought to be doing on the policy side, has delayed for many, many years actions that ought to be taken. I think as a result, we're going to see more impacts of climate change. The severity of climate change is going to get worse than it otherwise would have been if we had dealt with this problem, started to deal with it a long time ago. It's not going to be any single event. That we can't attribute single events to climate change. That's not the way it works. It's a growing influence on a whole lot of different events. And I think things are going to get a lot worse before they get better.
Well, let me thank everyone for I thank the reporters who called in. Thank Sherry Bollert, Peter Glick. Let me say the audio. We will post the entire audio at AmericanProgress.org. I'm not certain if we'll be able to do that today, but it will be within 24 hours. And if you need any further information regarding this press call, please call Christina at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, 202-481-8181.
This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.